Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuck sticks? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. How are you? It's been a horrendous few days. When I talked to you on Monday, I'd recorded that Sunday. So I had not witnessed, we had all had not witnessed all the horrors that happened over the next few days. My heart goes out to everybody in Las Vegas, everybody who had family, everybody in this country that had to watch another lunatic with a arsenal lose his fucking mind and kill people. And then later that afternoon, Tom Petty was taken to the hospital and kept on life support for a little while, and then he died. And a lot of people know that, who watched my special, that I had sort of brought Tom Petty up as a guy whose music connects all people, despite of political or affiliation or differences, and really represented what America can be when it's great. He was great. He's a great American singer and songwriter and great performer. And it was just gutted by the end of that day, man. Next couple of days are bad. There's no more good news, it doesn't seem. Just no more good news. There may be stories that provide some relief for a little while, but there's just no more good news. I don't know when that turns around. But I'll tell you, Tom Petty was great, and his music is still here, all of it. And I can tell you this, too. I saw him on the 22nd at the Hollywood Bowl, the second to the last show that he did in his life. And he was having a great fucking time. It couldn't have been an act. I think all of them were just thrilled to, not only for the tour to be over, but to be together as long as they've been together, to have all those great songs, to perform for people that love them, the Heartbreakers. But Tom looked like he was having a great fucking time. I can tell you that. I did witness that. And I've been listening to his music for the last couple of days. And that music will forever be here, even though Tom is no longer with us. He should have been for longer, but he isn't. And again, the disaster in Las Vegas, it just, we live in a country where any fucking idiot can get a gun or 50. And this happens. It's a real fucking horror show. And again, my heart goes out to everybody who lost people and the city, the country. Man, just when is there going to be some good news? How about now? This is a unique show today because we're going to be doing basically an audiobook version of the first chapter of Waiting for the Punch, Words to Live By from the WTF podcast. It's a book that Brendan and myself have put together. It comes out next Tuesday, October 10th. So this is a special thing we're doing today. This was the thing with the book. We had some interest in possibly doing a book of interviews with a few different book publishers. And, you know, some of the ideas were to put to publish interviews as whole entities, as the entire interview. And then we didn't really like that. We didn't see what the point of that was. And then we sort of come upon this other idea where we would break the book into themes that are often discussed on WTF, and then, you know, utilize our tremendous catalog of interviews to pull bits and pieces from conversations I've had with people that fit the theme. There's about a dozen themes in the book. And I'll tell you, man, when I read it over it, I had a very profound experience because I don't remember everything I've said to everybody. It's been over, we're in between 800 and 900 episodes here. And I was reading a lot of the bits and pieces. I'm like, I don't remember having this conversation, I thought to myself. And not only that, it really hits you in the guts, this fucking book. Like, all of it is very, when people talk, it comes at you at a different intensity than when people write. When you can craft a paragraph or a page and cut and paste and edit and grammatically correct everything, it's different than when someone's just talking to you. It goes in a different way. So the way this all sort of moves, this book, when you read it, it's just it's sort of a beautiful experience to read, you know, about 150, 160 different people's experience with these themes, and you kind of move through them all, through their personalities. It's an amazing experience to read the book. And the reason we're doing the episode like this today is because there is no audio version of the book. It really is a unique experience as a book, and we want it to have a life on the page. We made the book so it could be like its own thing. You know what I mean? Not just an extension of the podcast, but as a way to give everyone a taste of the book today, to just so they can get an idea of what it's like, we put together the first chapter as an audio collection. This is close to how the book is executed. Not exact, but very close. Chapter one is growing up. The other chapters of the book are sexuality, identity, relationships, parenting, addiction, mental health, failure, success, mortality, and life lessons. There are dozens of different people in each section, 158 total people. And how I'm going to do this today, I'm going to identify the speakers in this chapter by announcing their name the first time you hear them. But if they come up more than once, you'll only hear their name the first time. That'll help it flow better, more like the way it does when you're reading it. So I'll read my intro. I do an intro to every chapter. John Oliver did the intro to the book, the foreword to the book. I wrote a little intro to the book. Let's do it. I'll start with the first chapter, and I will read my intro, and then you will be engaged in the flow of people talking about growing.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Up.
Chapter 1. Growing Up. The Smaller Place It Came From.
I had my adventures and misadventures growing up, but it's the varying mixture of what I did or didn't get from my parents that really leaves a mark. The relationship we have with our parents explains how we engage with the world and other people. Sometimes bad experiences can lead us to a place of self-realization or, at the very least, give us a great story. Sometimes our childhood experiences take a lifetime to process, if ever. These stories define us, they haunt us, but they also can liberate us. I am positive I did not grow up properly. Does anyone really? Something is definitely off. There are obviously many reasons for whatever emotional flaws I have as an adult, and I can trace most of them to my parents. I have grown into a place of gratitude rather than resentment toward them, because it is essentially those flaws and my struggle with them that make me who I am. It is not really sympathetic or attractive to be actively mad at your parents after a certain age. You have to let it go at some point. It was 50 for me. My parents left me hanging in the providing the boundaries necessary for me to take chances and succeed and fail with the support and guidance necessary to define my character department. I had to put my sense of self together from scratch. I spent a good part of my life moving through the world like a kid lost at a mall, looking to other grown-ups as role models. I learned which cigarettes to smoke from Keith Richards. I dressed like Tom Waits for most of my junior year of high school. I looked to Woody Allen to understand what it meant to be smart and funny. My mother was a bit sarcastic and could be a little cutting. She was funny. She was always expressing herself in a creative way. My father was unpredictable and explosive at times. Sometimes that explosion would go in, sometimes out. He thought he was funny, but he wasn't. They both had a lot of energy. These are the things in the plus column. It's always good to learn about the struggles other people went through while they were growing up. I like that Paul Scheer felt comfortable sharing with me the very difficult situation he found himself in after his parents' divorce. Same with John Darnielle from the Mountain Goats, who is still dealing with the pain his stepfather put him through. I was able to laugh in disbelief at Molly Shannon's story of complete parental irresponsibility when she got on a plane without an adult and flew to New York City accompanied only by another child. I'm glad people still tell these stories about their childhoods. It took years of me talking to people in my garage to finally get some perspective on things I went through as a kid and stop them from undermining me as an adult. Well, that and a little therapy and some specific reading and age.
Conan O'Brien.
I think I was an anxious kid. I was, it's not a glamorous. I was not the class clown. I was funny for my friends, but quiet in the classroom. And I worked really hard, and I was kind of grim. And I have to say, I didn't really enjoy my childhood.
Socially uncomfortable?
I was not socially uncomfortable, no, because I could make my friends laugh. But I was not easygoing.
From fourth grade till when?
Till like now.
Sir Ian McKellen.
The first 3 years of my life, I didn't sleep in a bed. I slept on a mattress under a metal table in our downstairs room in case a bomb knocked the building over. So, and blackout material so that the lights didn't attract any German bombers that were coming over.
Do you remember that?
Oh, clearly. But and not much to eat, but quite healthy eating, rationing.
Yeah.
But, of course, you don't, when you're growing up, know that that's not the norm. And I was well looked after, a lot of love in my house.
Kevin Hart.
Grew up Philadelphia, PA.
Like what kind of area? What kind of neighborhood?
My neighborhood, shit. North Philadelphia, 15th area, you know, crime city. You know, right now I think we third in the world in deaths, probably.
Yeah.
New Year's, we opened it up with 5 murders in my city.
Yeah. Happy New Year.
Yeah, it's not the best place in the world, but I love it. It's home for me.
Mel Brooks.
My mother, Kitty.
Yeah.
Kitty Kaminsky.
Kitty Kaminsky.
Yeah, Kitty Kaminsky.
Yeah.
Raised 4 boys. You know, those days, diapers.
Sure.
You had to wash them.
Yeah, they brought them, and it was cloth.
I'll never forget one time I wanted to see a movie, and she gave me 3 deposit bottles. Yeah. Each one 3 cents apiece.
Milk bottles. Yeah.
And so that was 9 cents. You needed a dime.
Yeah.
And she went to, this is true, she went next door to Mrs. Miller.
Yeah.
And borrowed a penny, so I can make the dime. She was, I don't know if she was typical, but she was a wonderful, loving, caring, one beautiful mother.
RuPaul Charles.
I was watching a kid the other day.
Yeah.
It must have been about 4 years ago. And he was so happy to be in a human body. He was just jumping around and going up upside down. And he was running over there. And he came around and I was like, oh my God, it's great. Yeah. I'm a human. Look at me. Yeah. Look, I can do this.
Yeah.
I can do it. That's what I want
to do.
For
no reason.
Just to do it.
Just to move your hands, jump around, roll on the ground.
Exactly.
With an exhausted parent going, yes, you can. You can do that.
Exactly. But unfortunately, when I was a kid, my parents were in their own melodrama.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted, so I really couldn't. Do that as much as possible.
Well, selfish parents make you, they don't provide a place where you can feel comfortable to be yourself even.
Right.
You just get steamrolled.
Absolutely.
They don't pay attention. You don't get any reaffirmation or any affirmation at all.
Right.
Like, good for you, kid. That's great. You just sort of
Luckily for me, though, my sister, Renetta, who's moving to Louisiana, who was my soul sister, whom I moved to Atlanta with and who got married at 17, her.
Yeah.
She was my soul. She was the one who said, you're great. You should do this. Why don't you do that? I had that in my sister. So that was great.
Jim Gaffigan.
four boys and two girls, and I'm the youngest of six.
How old's your oldest brother?
The oldest in my family is my sister Kathy, and she's, she could be like 100 and I wouldn't know. And then my brother Mike is, 50s.
Yeah, somewhere in
there. It's all a blur, you know? It's like, who cares?
Well, you kind of know.
I mean, I kind of know that, you know, there's six kids over like 7 or 8 years. They're just old.
Now they're old.
They're older than me.
Yeah, but like, well, how old were you when you saw them all leave, I imagine?
Yes, yes.
I always wonder about that. Was that difficult? Do you remember?
Yeah, it was a little bit. You're leaving me here with these people that are crazy.
Your parents.
Yeah. You know, there's a little bit of, you know, the enthusiasm wanes, yeah. Right?
At
they're
six?
Like, oh, you're still here. Yeah, I'm still here. So there was some of that, but there was also, and I, you know, when I started off, I used to, there's such an amount of distrust that develops in parents of that generation. They had been lied to by so many teenagers. By the time I got there, they were just like, you're guilty. And I was like, I didn't do anything wrong. And they're like, just go to your room. And you're like, all right.
John Oliver.
When my dad first started taking me to games, mm-hmm. I would make him let me wear my full Liverpool kit. So this is me at 8, 9 years old. My full Liverpool kit underneath whatever I was wearing. Because there was a part of me as a child that felt, if someone got injured on the field,
I'm ready.
They would just turn to the crowd and say, does anyone have a kit so that we can carry on? And I would say, yes, my name is John. I'm 8 years old. And clearly, somewhere in me, I think that this is going to turn out well. That this 8-year-old is going to be able to physically compete with this 29-year-old super fit athlete.
But that's the dream. That's touching. I wish I had that. I didn't.
I wore cleats to the game as well.
You're ready
so you
to go.
Hear this clip clop of this 8-year-old kid going, let's do this.
Maria Bamford.
I used to play the violin.
Really?
Was very good at it because of a weird, you know, you start when you're 3, so you're all of a sudden.
You were playing violin at 3?
Yeah, because my parents
forced you? Did they take your hands to the strings?
It was forced in a way that I was unconscious of what was happening.
Yeah.
Until I was around 11, and
right.
Then I said, "Oh, I think I'd like to quit." And they said, "No. Oh, no. You cannot because we have put in a lot of time and money, and wow, you're freakishly good at it, so why not continue?" So I was good at it, but I did not enjoy it at all.
Paul Scheer.
My mom took my Weird Al Yankovic in 3D album and broke it over her knee because a song was on there. It was called Nature Trail to Hell, and it was on one of the devil worship lists that like the church had given them. Like, these, if your children have any of these albums, and one of them was a Weird Al album, you must find this and destroy it.
She destroyed it in front of you.
Yes.
And
that
what'd you
do? And my LL Cool J album.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, and it was terrible. I was crying, like, no, my Weird Al album. Like,
did you ever tell Weird Al that story?
I did, actually. I got to tell Weird Al that story, which was awesome. And a great full 360 there.
Oh, my God. How'd he respond?
He just thought it was insane because the song is called Nature Trail to Hell in 3D about going to a drive-in to see a horror movie called Nature Trail to Hell in 3D. Like, there's nothing satanic about Weird Al Yankovic at all. Like, in the greatest stretch of the imagination. But, like, you know, and I'd listen to In Excess, and my mom's
like, that might be Satan.
It might be.
You never know. They're
you
very
never know.
Cunning. He's charming.
And that's it. That was
very
Weird Al.
Funny, yeah.
Satan comes in Hawaiian shirts.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
But my mom, like, took all my action figures away and gave me, like, Ten Commandments figures.
On,
like, I had, like,
on.
I had Moses, like, literally a Moses action figure, and he had, like, two tablets in his hand, like,
oh,
the Ten Commandments.
Oh, come on. You're kidding me.
Oh, no.
What'd you do with those action figures?
I would play with them like I would play Batman or G.I. Joe. Like,
flying Moses?
Yeah, like, I would. I would, like, make them, like, I'd make Moses, like, swing down a pole and change and get into a Batmobile. I had still the Batmobile, so Moses drive a Batmobile.
We were hardcore Catholic growing up.
I mean, church every Sunday?
My parents are, the whole nine yards. It's in my bones. I mean, as much as I've tried to evolve past it in certain ways, it's in my bones.
What are the liabilities of it, carrying it with you in your mind?
Body shame.
Really?
Yeah. Just, you know, it's funny because I've been accused over the years of, oh, you're so, you know, you're self-deprecating and that's your act. And I was like, you know, that really comes from finding myself, very flawed. I think that's at the root of Catholicism, is we're just flawed. And so
there's nothing we can do about it.
And there's nothing we can do about it. And so I grew up just, you know, having a very dark self-view.
What,
in a lot of ways.
You were too tall or too what?
Too skinny, too tall. You know, my dick's too big. Yeah. You know, it's just going to hurt somebody. Well, I hate to get that out there as a rumor, but do you know what I mean? My dick is huge.
Yeah,
and I've got a lot of girth.
Hurt people. You don't want to hurt people.
Well, no, the thing is, and I was so worried for a long time, and I actually had doctors say, you're going to hurt someone with that. And then it was only later in life that I found out that, you know, this is a great gift, but...
For years,
I lived with the shame of this, you know, my penis is too big. I hope no woman ever finds out.
Handicapped. Yeah. Horrible handicap.
And so, you know, you live with these things and then you eventually you learn to work with them. I was not a hypochondriac, but I probably feigned illnesses to get my parents' attention. But I don't think I was I didn't believe I had the illness. I just, you know, when you're one of six, you got to do anything to get some face time. So I was not beyond trying to just, have something. I mean, I remembered envying. I read Death Be Not Proud.
Yeah.
With the John Gunther Jr. story. John
the baseball
Gunther
player?
Wrote about some. No, Death Be Not Proud is about the boy who's like 14 and he gets a brain tumor.
Oh.
And it's really touching. And everyone, you know, you're supposed to read it when you're 13, 14 years old.
Yeah.
And you're supposed to just feel so terrible for the boy.
Yeah.
And I read it and I thought, man, that guy's getting so much attention. I remembered envying a kid with a brain tumor. And he dies at the end of the book. And I remember thinking, man, the brain tumor, that's the way to go.
The presents he got.
Yeah, that's bad.
Norm MacDonald.
When I was very young, I was very, very, very shy and very afraid of everything. I mean, people say they're shy when they're kids, but I was like, it was a pathology.
Aren't you still afraid of everything? I am. I mean, I try to hide it and deal with it, but on a day-to-day basis,
I'm not afraid of everything. I'm afraid of very few things.
Like what?
Illness, death.
Yeah. How'd you get peace of mind out of the other shit?
Well, when I was this is a weird thing that happened to me when I was young.
Yeah.
I don't know if this means anything.
Let's try it.
I remember it, but it was a moment I had that was it wasn't religious or epinephic or anything, but it transformed me to some degree, is that I was always fucking so afraid of everything. And if I went to a store, I'd have to walk around forever before I could even face a person in the store to buy a pack of gum. I don't know why the fuck I was like this.
Yeah.
But anyways, when I was nine, there was a we lived in rural Ontario, and there was a blind friend of my dad's that I had to, he said, take him to the store. I was like, what the fuck? Like, I have to take this blind fucker? And I'm already shy and shit. So I'm taking him to the store, and then the fucker wants me to explain everything, describe everything to him.
Yeah.
So I'm like, there's some grass over here, and now there's a lamppost, and this guy's all happy. Oh, what about the lamppost? I mean, it's just a lamppost.
Yeah.
So it goes on and on, but something happened to me during, it sounds bizarre, but something happened to me where I was actually, instead of always looking inward, which I think I'd always done before that one time, I was looking outward. Anyways, while I was talking to him, I suddenly had a sort of a hysteria, like I was laughing. I started laughing and stuff. And I don't even know why I'm remembering this, but I started laughing about everything. And everything seemed like... very, very funny to me. And then a couple of weeks later, I saw a homeless guy, and he started talking to me.
Yeah.
And he was talking to me about John D. Rockefeller. He's like, I was at John D. Rockefeller's funeral.
Yeah.
And all this shit.
Yeah.
And I was laughing at him and shit. And then he started laughing. And I was like, it's all fucking crazy shit. Like, something came to me.
Yeah.
Where I started. And so now I find everything funny except like death and shit.
Molly Shannon.
I was raised by my dad from the time I was really little.
Yeah.
We were in a really bad car accident when I was really little. I was four, and my dad was driving, and my mom was killed, and my little sister was three, and my cousin. Mm. So it was very hard on my dad. He had to recover. He was very badly injured, so we went to live with my aunt. So it was very complicated. It was a lot of sadness from a very young age.
Yeah.
But then also my dad was like a real survivor. He drank when we were little, but then he got into recovery.
Oh, good.
I think it was that generation of, you know, he was very Catholic, but repressed in a lot of ways. So there was some sadness with that. But he was also really charismatic and fun and would do anything. And he was real wild. So it, and really.
Like what? That was like such a great buildup. Like, we're going to go on the roller coaster with no seatbelts.
Like, we would do crazy stuff. Like, we would go to the airport and we'd be like, let's take a, you know, a mystery trip. And we would have no, you know, no suitcases or anything. And
really?
It was when they had those airlines where you could pay right on the airplane. Do you remember
that? You didn't have to.
People's Express.
You didn't have to even fly under your name in the old days. Anybody's name.
So it was completely. So we would go to the airport, pick a city, and just fly to the city, and then borrow clothes when we got there, or buy clothes, like crazy stuff. And my dad would call in sick for me to school, like very eccentric.
Sounds like a great father.
Come on, fuck school. We're going on an airplane.
He had depression, and I think he would also could be really, he'd go up and down.
Sure, so that's exciting.
So I think he had fun.
I have one of those. It's very exciting.
Like
you literally went to cities and you didn't have clothes, so you'd buy clothes.
Yeah, I'd borrow a bathing suit from the woman that worked behind the counter, and you know, like crazy stuff like that. And then I hopped a plane when I was 12. We told my dad, me and my friend Anne, we're like, we're going to hop a plane to New York. And he was like, he dared us.
Yeah.
So we
How
went
old
to
were you?
We were like 12.
Oh, good. That's
so
good.
We went to the airport and we had ballet outfits on and we put our hair in buns and we wanted to look really innocent. And this was, again, when flying was really easy. You didn't need your ticket to get through.
Apparently, you didn't need an adult either.
And we told my dad and we were just like, we saw there were two flights. We were either going to go to San Francisco or New York. And we thought, oh, let's go to New York. It's leaving early. So we went. We said to the stewardess, we just want to say goodbye to my sister. Can we go on the plane? And she was like, sure. And then she let us on. And it was a really empty flight because it was out of Cleveland, Ohio.
Yeah.
And we sat back there. And then all of a sudden, you just hear like, the plane takes off. We were like, and we had like little ballet outfits and buns, and I was like, "Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed the fruit of thy womb, Jesus, Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for sinners now and at the hour of our death." And then the stewardess that had given us permission to go say goodbye to my sister came by to ask if we wanted snacks or beverages, and she was like, "Can I get you ladies something to eat?" She looked like she was like, "Oh, motherfucker," you know. So she, so we wondered if we were going to get in trouble, but she ended up not telling anyone. And then when we landed in New York City, she was like, "Bye, ladies. Have a nice trip."
It's such an exciting story, but the irresponsibility of all the adults in this story is somehow undermining my appreciation of it. You were 12-year-old girls in fucking ballet outfits, and everybody's sort of like, have a good time. What world was that?
It was a crazy world.
What did you do in New York? And now you're going to say, we got drunk and we went to a...
Well, again, because I had a crazy childhood, we called my dad. We were like, we did it. And he was like, oh, Dad, Molly. Oh, geez, we'll try to... So basically, he couldn't...
Try to what?
He didn't know what to do. He said, try to see if you could stay... Go find a hotel that you could stay in.
Oh, my God.
Me and Mary, my sister, will come meet you. We'll drive there. So basically, we were like, all right, we'll try to find a hotel. But he was kind of excited because he liked crazy stuff. But basically, we didn't have that much. We just had our ballet bags and a little bit of cash. So we went to a diner and we dined and dashed and we stole things. We were like little con artists.
Wait, did you actually make it to the city?
We made it to the city. We just asked people. I was like, how do you get to Rockefeller Center? Because I just seen TV.
And you're still in your ballet outfit.
Ballet outfit, yeah. Really.
No, nobody said, are you girls lost? Nothing like that?
No, nothing.
They went into a bar and they got, drink up, ladies.
Yeah. So we did try to go to hotels, and my dad would call and ask, could they just stay there till we get there? And none of the hotels wanted to be responsible.
Oh, my God.
So he was like, all right, you got to come home. And he was like, but I'm not paying for it, so try to hop on one on the way back. So we tried to hop on many planes, but the flights were all so crowded.
Right.
So we ended up having to have him pay for it, and he made us pay for him, pay it all back with our babysitting money.
Oh, holy. So that was the big punishment?
Yeah, there was no punishment. Well,
no, I know. Yeah. I mean, clearly, was there any sort of like, oh, you survived, I was just testing you?
He loved that kind of stuff. Like I said, he was wild. He used to, in his drinking days, he would, you know, go to bars, and if somebody didn't let him in, he'd be like,
damn it. You know, he'd go into the bar and knock all the glasses down. He was like a kind of guy who could maybe get arrested. Like, it was crazy.
I love the sort of strange nostalgic excitement you have for this borderline child abuse.
Complicated.
Oh, now you're going to say that? Yeah, there's this one story that's complicated. But
he was also a very loving parent. I think it's complicated. Also really supportive and kind of made me feel like I could do anything. And so in that way, it felt really free and wild. But then in other ways, I had to learn the rules of like how regular people live.
From other people.
Yeah. Like professionals. Like people you pay. Yeah. You know what I mean?
John Darnielle.
Okay, so I want you to think.
Yeah.
Wherever you were when you were five, right?
Yeah.
Where was it?
Wayne, New Jersey.
Oh, man. And with both parents?
Yeah.
Do they still own this house or have they moved?
Oh, no. We lived there. We left when I was about six, but it was a red brick apartment complex.
Cool. Okay.
That's where I first saw the harmony guitar. That's where awesome. I first remember it being played.
Oh, that's an amazing memory. So, but when you think of it, when you think of yourself standing in it, does it seem like you have room to run around and to be a kid?
No, not really.
Not really. For my place seemed big to me in my mind. The hallway.
Yeah.
I remember running all the way to the end of the hallway and running all the way back down and being exhausted.
Yeah, man,
I'm running all the way to the heater at the end and back. Yeah. That's two steps, right?
No,
now that I've been in the house, it's two paces. And I remember running down that hallway and the distance between my room and my parents' room, which I remember being a walk. It's like if I have to go see Dad to talk to him about something, I'm going to walk down the hall. I'm going to get a talking to, you know?
Right.
It's two steps.
So those memories were like of what, 3 years old, 4 years old?
Four, three.
And those were the only things you really remembered?
I remember, well, the thing is like we had added a room while I was there and it was called the front room. Mm-hmm. And I remembered it being a cavernous big room with a very high ceiling. It's a fucking garage. It's the tiniest. It's where the students live now because now it's a rental unit. There was a fucking poster of Biggie and Tupac on the front door. I was so stoked. and I was like, well, these people won't mind if I knock on their door.
Did they know who you were?
No, they had never heard of me. I was glad. That would have been really awkward. So,
oh, my God.
Hey, it's not, oh, really? This is my old house. Could I come in and feel sad about shit?
You don't mind if I come in and weep in the hallway, do you?
No, that was what I did. I walked in, I looked around and just went, whoa. So this is a bedroom now because this is the front room. We had a piano in there and a stereo.
Were you telling this to whoever lived
there? A little
there?
Bit, but for the most part, I didn't want to stay.
So you're sort of like the weird old guy that kind of came by and they
The weird permanently young guy who came by. But no, it's like I wanted to keep it uninvasive. I wanted to go, I know this is strange, but I lived here when I was a child and I am a musician. I happen to be playing in town. If I could just come in just to see the house I used to live in just for a second, that would be awesome. And they let me right in. I looked at the backyard and I looked at my old room. And I nodded and said thank you and then told my therapist about it when I got home. But it wasn't that traumatic. It was like, it was interesting. It was kind of sweet in a way. It was good to see. It's when you feel like you're okay with where your life is at, it's good to see the smaller place it came from.
Ahmed.
Then my parents immigrated to the States. I was a month old.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I was like a Lion King.
Yeah.
we're going to America.
Ahmed.
And then we ended up in Riverside, California, which is where I was raised. And we were the only Arab family, not only on the block, but in the whole, almost the whole city, really.
All white? What is that?
Wow, yeah. Well, you know.
Latino?
It was interesting because we ended up in this little, like, cool little suburb outside of, L.A. and Riverside. And, close to the college campus, UCR.
Mm-hmm.
It was very like middle class and a little bit lower middle class, mostly white families. But then our high school was really racially diverse. We were black, Mexican, Asian. And we were sort of considered like the thug high school. Like, you know, athletes would come and do really well there. But there was also some gang violence and that sort of thing.
Right.
But when I was in high school, you know, I blended in perfectly. Like nobody really, they were like, you know, what is it? Where are you from? Like they didn't really
You mean
understand.
If you didn't say your name?
Even when I'd say my name and they'd hear Egypt, they were always sort of mystified by it. You know? And I'd get the little jokes like, you know, did you come in on your flying carpet? And did you climb a pyramid? And do you have camels? And like all
those jokes have changed now.
Generic, yeah. Now it's like, do you fly planes? Do you not? Are you good in chemistry? You know?
Yeah.
Do you use fertilizer every day?
Yeah.
How many wives do you have?
Uh-huh. I remember growing when I was a kid, thinking my family's weird. We're just weird. I don't know how to put my
my finger on it. Yeah. But I grew up thinking we're not, and maybe everyone grows up that way, but I remember thinking we're kind of like an Irish Catholic Adams family. Like there's something off with us. So I very much grew up feeling we're, now my mother would be horrified. She'd say, that's not true. How dare, my mother is Margaret Dumont in the Marx Brothers movies. Well, I don't know why you would say that. That's not true. Yeah. But that was the feeling that my brothers and sisters all had, was we're an odd family, and we never quite knew what we were.
The kids would come over, you know, to my house, and this is a joke I used to do because it's a true story. One of my friends walked in, and my parents were praying, and he looked at me and he said, "What are they looking for?" And I was like, they're praying. And he's like, "To who?" And I'm like, so I always had to explain what Islam was and talk about, you know, the belief of it all behind it. We were like the Arab Munsters. we were like the Arab Adam family. We were like the weird family on the block, because my mom was always cooking, you know, stuff with like spices that Americans weren't used to, like cumin and, you know, stuff like that, garlic, and all these weird fumes would be, you know.
And you bring friends over and you'd have to explain.
They're like, what are they, you know, what's your mom cooking? Yeah. Cow brains? Yeah. Or, you know, whatever. And my dad, you know, he is a night owl, so he'd sit up till 3-4 in the morning watering the grass, smoking cigarettes. By, you know, watering by hand.
Yeah.
So the neighbors were always like, "What are you doing out there for?" You know.
So you were religiously odd, and then actually odd.
And on top of that, because my parents only ate halal food or kosher food, they didn't sell it back then in the 70s at stores. So my dad had to drive to Fontana, California, with our station wagon and load up. He'd go to a farm and load up the station wagon with chickens and ducks and rabbits.
And do it himself.
And they'd bring it back. We had a live meat locker basically in our backyard.
Really?
And every day around 5, my mom and dad would go out to the backyard and they'd pick out a chicken, and my dad would hold it down and say the Muslim prayer, "Please bless this soul and let our family have sustenance."
No.
And my mom would do the there's a way you sacrifice, they say.
Cut the head off?
So the animal doesn't suffer. And, you know, and she, you know, it's like Clash of the Titans. She's holding up this head and she's got blood all over her. And I was like, and we were eating dinner by, you know, by 9 p.m. The funny thing was the kids would come over during the day from the neighborhood and play with the rabbits or the chickens or whatever. And they'd come back to find their favorite rabbit they're playing with and it was gone. They're like, "What happened to Fluffy?"
Yeah.
We ate him. We're eating his sister tonight.
Dave Attell.
I do mostly my dad on stage. You know, like my dad, I used to work for my dad. So I do.
What did
like
he do? Work where?
We used to, my parents had a bridal dress tuxedo rental shop.
Yeah.
And I worked there from the time I was like 16 till I was, I guess, 19.
Yeah.
And, you know, which is, I guess, slave, you know, underage, whatever, right? No, right. I guess not 16. But I was like,
what was your job there? Like getting shoes?
I cleaned the store. I was head of shipping and receiving. I sold shoes.
You're head of shipping and receiving?
Yeah, it was me and my grandpa. So I was his boss. And my dad used to, the way he used to talk to me, I do that on stage as my control voice.
Yeah.
Which helps me. You know?
What is that voice?
You know, the sarcastic, whatchamacallit, biting, cutting dude.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it works. It definitely works. Because I realized that's how men talk.
Yeah.
My dad was a man, and that's how men talked, and they didn't give, you know, they would do things. Like, I one time saw my dad with diabetes, full-blown, you know, like diabetes, lift like 150-pound cash register, like one of these old cash registers just by himself, and I was the guy who was, like, working out. You know, back then, every kid in Long Island lifted weights and practiced karate. I couldn't lift it, and he, like, just fucking lifted it, put it over there, lit a cigar, and said, like, "Okay, what next? What do we have to do next?" And I'm like, only a man can do that, because he knew it had to be done.
Russell Peters.
My dad was a meat inspector.
Really?
Yeah, he worked in a chicken plant.
Oh my God!
So you know he just fucking.
Did you ever go to work with him?
No, he had to wear whites and rubber boots and a hard hat and
horrendous.
And he would come out stinking every day.
It's horrendous.
And my mom worked in the cafeteria at Kmart.
No,
remember those cafeterias they used to have in the back with the Salisbury steak?
And yeah.
And a great day for us would be when there was Salisbury steak left over. My mom would bring it home.
No.
Yeah.
Are you serious?
Or hot dogs? I'm like, yes.
Special night.
Yes.
Oh my God.
So there was nothing. There wasn't ever like the. And, you know, everyone always asks me, what about being a doctor or a lawyer? I'm like, there's none in my family.
Joe Mandy.
Both of my parents were trial lawyers. So I just, there was a few years where I just didn't talk to my parents because they would just, oh man, between my sister and I, we would just get cross-examined on everything.
Oh my God.
That was just how we were raised. Just constant.
So always looking for the lie?
They were always looking for the lie, even that it was just, it was crazy. So, and my parents have, are much
They never
better.
Said that my client, my son.
There was basically, I mean, but like we would be sitting at a dinner table and if they smelled anything fishy, they were back on the clock and just grilling us until they figured out what the issue was or whatever. And so,
oh my God.
And my sister and I both handled that in different ways. Cause I think from 7th to 10th grade, I just basically just pleaded the fifth on everything. You know what I mean? I just didn't talk to them cause I didn't want to incriminate myself. So I really like, there was a few years where I hardly ever talked to my parents.
Just out of fear of being, grilled.
Yeah. And my sister, on the other hand, she sort of just pled insanity. My sister was just this like wall of noise. She just like everything was just anytime my parents tried to confront her on it, she'd just scream and slam her door. And that was, I kind of jealous. Actually, that's a much better tactic. I just internalized everything.
Ron Funches.
I remember my first day of school, my mom was just being like, hey, like some kids are going to like you. Some kids are not going to like you for who you are. Don't ever change who you are for them. Just like if kids like you, cool. If they don't, fuck them.
That she said that?
Mm-hmm.
God damn. I wish I had your mom.
She made her own mistakes. But she's like, pretty awesome.
In high school, they thought I had the most like severe case of IBS they'd ever seen. They thought it was stomach cancer because I literally for about 4 years woke up every morning with just explosive diarrhea. Just every morning. Just that was just my part of my routine.
Have you got any good shitting in public stories in your pants?
There was one time. Actually, there was one time I was on a conclave.
Sorry, being like, insensitive.
No, it's fine. It's my life, you know, shitting all the time. I was at this thing for my Jewish youth group when I was like 15.
Jewish youth group stories.
Yeah, and we were on a bus in Wisconsin, and we had just gone to Taco Bell. So I mean, already red flags.
Did you know when you were eating it that?
I mean, yeah, it's always like sort of Russian roulette with Mexican food.
Yeah,
Mexican roulette.
Yeah,
and. Immediately, I just knew I had to go, and it was like in a school bus.
Yeah.
So there was no bathroom, and I had to go up to my rabbi, the front of the bus, and say, you know, bad things are happening to me. We really need to pull over at the next rest stop. And he was like, yeah, I'll make sure of it. So we went back. I went back to the back of the bus, and you know, the rest stop was 5 miles ahead. And I'm just like, you know,
come
pacing
on,
and then the bus driver just blew right past it. And the next rest stop wasn't for like 45 miles. And I didn't know I my body was going to explode, you know,
yeah.
And to this day, I can't listen to Tom Petty without thinking of I put on the Wildflowers album. And I, like the only time I've ever successfully meditated. But I meditated for those 45 minutes to the next rest stop and ran. And my friend was in the bathroom and he said he's never heard a human body make those kinds of noises. I was in there for, everyone on the bus is waiting for me. I was in there for like 35 minutes just
so that
evacuating.
Is an amazing testament to the power of meditation and complete fear of peer judgment.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I probably hurt my body in the long run the way I was clenching
because
every muscle.
That is a superhuman feat.
Mm-hmm.
That is almost Nietzschean.
I still to this day I don't know how I did it because it was bad.
This is not my nose. My nose was completely rebuilt.
Shattered.
No, it was. I was beaten up.
Serious?
I ran into I'm not kidding. I ran into a street gang who, and I was wearing a T-shirt that had the Irish flag on it, and they were Italian, and this was right near the aquarium in Boston,
down
and
by
I was
the
with
water.
I was with my friend at the time, John Medeiros, and this is late high school,
so it's near the North End, kind of.
Yeah, and they beat the shit out of me.
Got to him too?
No, left him alone, because I was a little bit of a wise guy. They said they wanted 50 cents, and I said no, and they said why not, and I said I don't feel like it. And just as I finished that the T sound, I got hit so hard in the face.
Did you fight back?
I mean, I got hit a bunch of times so hard in the face that I don't think I did much. I don't remember. And I remember it was over pretty quickly. And then I had to have I went to the emergency room. And the doctor, I'll never forget his name, Dr. Constable, he had a British accent. And he looked kind of crazy. He had crazy hair, and he looked like the poet Ezra Pound. And I said, is my nose broken? And he said, broken? Good God, man. It's a bag of bones. I'll never forget that. That's a true story.
in ninth grade, I took Spanish in high school. It was the only non-honors class I ever took. I showed up the first day, ninth grade, so I was very short and braces and sweater vests. I don't know why I wore sweater vests. And
what
I
made you do that?
What? I thought it was cool. and I got into Spanish the first day of class, and it was just me and the JV basketball team. That was the class, basically.
Right.
And I was like, it'll be fine. I listened to Outkast or whatever. And I sit down, and they were just ruthless. They would make fun of me. They would call me names. They would choke me. I got choked a lot, but it was never violent. They just would come up from behind when I wasn't expecting it and like wrap. Sometimes it was like piano wire. They had piano wire. They would like wrap wire around my neck, and I would freak out. Obviously,
yeah,
and then they would let go and just crack up. They'd be like, "Ah, ha, ha, you stupid!"
Yeah, yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
and he's like, "Oh,
he's frightened for the right reason."
Right.
What an idiot!
Right. What an idiot! I was like, "How stupid of me to freak out!"
Yeah.
So it was bad, and they would throw like empty cans of soda at my head and stuff. And it sucked. And
the teacher just let this happen.
Yeah, our teacher, that Spanish teacher, was so broken. You know, she was so done with life that she, like, it was chaos.
Like, when she was an older public school teacher.
Yep, she looked like Newman from Seinfeld, so everyone called her Newman. Like, they would call her Miss Newman, and she would respond to that. I mean, it was bad. And then that December, our principal made this big announcement that there no more gambling was allowed in the hallways.
Was there gambling?
Yeah, people like played dice in the hallways and stuff.
Oh,
and
my God.
And
what kind of fucking high school
is this? It was crazy.
Active dice games?
There were active dice games. There were like the Asian.
Like, come on, seven!
The Asian kids would have breakdance competitions in between classes.
Like,
In the hallway. And I actually started doing this thing. I do it on stage sometimes too. I got really good at making it look like I was about to start breakdancing. Because actually, I was just trying to get through the hallway, right? But I would get in the middle of this like big circle, and it would be like my turn, and I would start like moving around to the music and pumping my shirt and making it look like I was about to, and I would just do it until they realized I was never going to start breaking. And I would go for like 2 minutes without actually doing any dance before they like pushed me out of the circle.
God.
But anyway, but back to the story. So our principal, she instituted this no gambling policy, and I saw an opportunity, and I went up to these kids in the back of my class, and I was like, you know, I can teach you a gambling game that you'll never get in trouble for playing if you just stop choking me, right?
And it was that clear. There was a negotiation. Like,
yeah, it was a clear negotiation, and they thought about it, and the next day I taught them how to play dreidel for money.
Stop it.
I swear. Yeah. And so for like a good month outside my Spanish class, you would walk by and just see these black kids in like Averex jackets huddled over a top. Yeah, just like, yo, that's a W, motherfucker. Pay up.
Ali Brosh.
I was never a cool kid.
Right.
They sort of like made an attempt to maybe I could be in that group, but I was too scared.
They reached out. They sent a representative.
And I was too scared. I was, no, I'm not going to.
Not cool.
Not
too much pressure.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to keep up with music.
And yeah.
And figure out what people are wearing. So you felt like an outsider?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was always an awkward kid.
Mm-hmm.
I just never, I was always behind, never knew what to do with myself or like how to be.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I got most of my, my best friend, this is this kid named Joey. He was a cool kid, and I never was. And I always felt very intimidated by him. And much of my early life was defined by trying to get him to think that I was cool.
Uh-huh.
And he would, you know, give me advice on like how to dress.
Yeah.
So I spent, you know, my early preteen years wearing like JNCO jeans and baggy shirts.
Yeah.
Just totally.
Sure.
Like rocking the skater guy look.
Yeah. Yeah. And you never felt comfortable?
I mean, I didn't fit into anybody but him. Like he didn't know what he was doing either is the thing. Like he didn't know what he was doing.
So he was pulling it off.
To me, he looked like,
right.
Like he looked like he knew what he was
doing.
So
he confided into you that like, look, I don't know what's going on either. So
he didn't confide in me. It's just now that we're adults, I can clearly see that.
Oh, like, you're still friends with him?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So it lasted?
Yeah.
That's great. And you, at initially it wasn't a dating thing, it was just pals?
No,
you just felt like
just
outsiders?
Buddies.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I was like the tumor on his life. He saw that I wasn't meshing with, like, he found this group of cool friends, and I wasn't meshing with the cool friends.
What do you mean we're meshing? How does that happen? Like, what moment signifies that for you? The unmeshing?
They could just tell, like, cool kids have this sense where they can just know that you aren't one of them, right? And they can see, like, and okay, so it also didn't help that about 3 months earlier, my friend Joey had dared me to shave my head.
You did that?
I did that. Because he dared me to, and I didn't want to look like
people that don't know who they are can't shave their heads.
Yeah, exactly. And I didn't know who I was. And
I did that.
I hadn't worried about it up till that point, really.
And what happened?
Well, so this was, I was 13, I think, when I shaved my head. And this, it was like, it was really bad timing. It was about 2 weeks before I discovered that I'm interested in boys.
Yeah.
I had no, like, no view of self before this, no, like, no self-consciousness, nothing. Then I shaved my head and I discovered, wow, I'm not pretty. And
it was pure. Like, this was unadulterated.
It
like
was, yeah, it
no
was,
distraction with hair. This
yeah,
just
it was nothing.
Baseline.
And I had giant braces. And you know, when you do something like that, like, yeah, when you do something that's so obviously, like, it just shows that you don't know how to fit, you know, do the things that show people you can be one of them. Like, they see you and they're like, there's something wrong here.
My dad sent me to a Dale Carnegie training course on how to win friends and influence people.
Really?
For 18 weeks, I went and with some businessmen and women, and it
you
saved
were
16? Me. It saved me. Really? Yeah. Like, I was super depressed, was like sleeping all day through school, and I was like, okay, and I totally did all the things, and suddenly, like, I was able to have friendships, you know, like, where just had a format of how to talk to people.
Uh-huh.
And because I had so much anxiety, and so, you know, I would say, hi, Mark. Mark, it's really great to see you. You know, Mark, your set was so great last night, Mark. And then you listen to people, and then you tell the person back what they just said, but with a positive spin on it. And it was fantastic, I tell you. And, like, immediate results.
Really?
Yeah. And then it all crashed down. I went to college, and people on the East Coast were like, why are you talking like that to me? Why are you all, just calm down.
Oh, no.
You know, and I'm
where'd
like,
you go to college?
I was at Bates College in Lewiston, Maine. So, and I think there was an air of hysteria with my Dale Carnegie techniques in college because I was very afraid. So I'm sure they were telling me to calm down for good reason.
So you're smiling a lot and very wired. Yeah. And you're like, oh, very nice.
Gillian Jacobs.
My interests were always very different than what other kids my age were into. So I think that we didn't really have a lot to talk about. And I think the more they didn't understand me, the louder I talked about what I was into. So they just didn't know what to make of me.
Did you wear costumes and whatnot? Or what?
I didn't wear costumes to school, no, but my mom would only let me buy clothes that she approved of. So I had, like, I wore a lot of sweater sets in high school because she liked sweater sets. And
in high school still?
Yeah.
You couldn't fight that, didn't
no,
you?
No, no. I remember, like, going to an outlet store and wanting to buy a skirt that it was not a revealing skirt, it was a floor-length skirt. But my mom was like, I don't like it. The material looks cheap, and she wouldn't let me buy it.
So you were stuck in sweater outfits?
I was stuck dressed like a middle-aged woman, yeah.
The Amazing Jonathan.
I used to be able to bend spoons. I figured out how to bend a spoon with using my mind, but it was just misdirection. I would make them look away for a second, I would bend it.
Is that what most hand is?
Yeah, but I could did it really, really well, and I did it for my physics teacher, who I really admired, and he said to me, is that real? Are you really doing this, or is it a trick?
Yeah.
And I was really unpopular in school. I was, like, not standing out at all.
Yeah.
So I lied, and I said, yeah, I can really do it, thinking that would be the end of it.
Yeah.
Nah, and the next hour I'm sitting in class, I hear on the speaker, Jonathan, John Zellis, please come to the principal's office. This has something to do with the spoon bending. I know it does.
Yeah.
I walk in there, there's my mom and my dad, who they call out of work, a bunch of spoons on the desk, and a local reporter from the Macomb Daily paper.
Yeah.
And I'm like, fuck, this is not good.
So the physics teacher set you up to this?
Yeah, he asked me if it was real, and I lied to him and said, yeah. So he told, and they got a reporter to come down. They wanted me to demonstrate my powers. My mom took me aside before this. I said, can you really do this, or are you just lying. Yeah. And I looked her straight in the eye and I said, I can really do it. It's like a snowball going right down. I said, I can really do it.
Yeah.
And so I proceeded to bend all the spoons and they freaked out. And then I thought,
You succeeded in the trick all times.
Yeah. I bent everything and the reporter's, he's chomping at the bit to do this great story about a psychic kid. Yeah. But I had to figure a way out of it because I figured that the magicians, local magicians, would bust me on it and make me a fraud.
But they can't give away the trick. Why would they?
Well, they would say I'm lying. That this is what he's doing. Like magicians do. You know, magicians they bust Uri Geller for doing it.
Yeah,
they'll bust me too. If it's in the paper, you can bet someone's going to come forward and go, that's bullshit. He's
right,
just tricking.
Right.
So I had to figure a way out of it, and this is how I got out of it.
Yeah,
I told my mom that I did want to be a normal kid. I didn't want to be a freak at the school. I just wanted to be a normal kid. I didn't want everyone looking at me like I was weird. And she bought it. They all bought it. And nobody did the story. But it leaked. This is the good part. It leaked out. And yeah. I didn't get that press, which I didn't want. But everyone thought I was this mysterious. And I got mad pussy. I got like mad pussy
Come
in my
on.
Senior year.
Yeah?
I did, yeah.
Oh, because you were like the wizard.
Yeah, I was like man who fell to earth.
Yeah.
And yeah. So.
And that's when you knew show business was the thing?
Yeah. Like yeah. Man, if a chick thinks that you can read her mind or anything like that, you're in.
Did you try to do that with chicks?
Oh, yeah. When they go to the bathroom, I'd go in through their purse, take their license out, get their birth date, know their zodiac sign. I have all the details. We could put it back fast in their purse. They'd come back and hey, we'd be doing lines. And let me touch your forehead for a minute. Boom, you're a Virgo.
John Glazer.
I remember my stepdad telling me about that when he and my mom told me they were getting married. I was in high school. And he said he was actually very impressed about how I handled it. Like they just told me they were getting married. I remember both of those moments. When my mom and my stepdad got married, I was probably 14. And he said, I just sort of like sat there quietly.
Yeah.
You know, just took it in.
Uh-huh.
Kind of just got up from the table, went upstairs, put on like shorts and t-shirt and my running shoes and just went jogging. But it wasn't like I could go like running somewhere and then come back.
Right.
We lived in this apartment complex
right.
that sort of had a loop. So like they told me they were getting married and then I just left and they watched me run laps.
Around the building?
But he said he was, well, it was like around five buildings.
Yeah.
It wasn't just like quick laps.
Right.
But he said he was like, I'm very impressed how he's handling this and he's dealing with it.
Yeah.
But also when my dad, I remember when he told me he was getting remarried the first time.
Yeah.
I was in sixth grade and I was taking violin lessons. I was doing, I think, the Suzuki.
Uh-huh.
And he picked me up and my mom always picked me up. So right away, I'm like, all right. Okay.
This is after their divorce, obviously.
Yes. Yes.
They live close by. How old were you when they got divorced?
I was probably 8.
Yeah.
And so now sixth grade.
Was that devastating?
It was pretty weird. I have vague memories of it, but I remember being just crying and sitting on the steps and just being really upset and yelling. But I don't remember the moment.
Right.
It's just all kind of vague. But I do remember it being upsetting. But when he was getting remarried the first time, I do remember, picking me up from violin and... That was already something. I know something's up. Something's not right.
Yeah.
And then, hey, I thought we'd, go get a bite to eat, anywhere you want to go. I was like, all right, the fuck is going on?
Yeah.
And there was a sub shop, ironically enough, because I know I do all this sandwich humor stuff, which people are probably like, all right, we get it. You like sandwiches. But there was a place that I liked right across the street. And it was more about like, oh, well, let's just go there. Like
right.
I didn't, it wasn't like I was going to say, oh great, let's go to this great place. Yeah. I just knew something was up.
Yeah.
So we went there, but it wasn't a sit down place. So we get these sandwiches and just go sit in his car in the parking lot.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's facing the school across the street. And I'm just sitting there kind of, very kind of tight,
eating your sandwich,
eating my sub and it's right next to me and, tight to my chest. And I kind of felt like I knew what was coming.
Yeah.
The more I'm just trying to think about like what is going on.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, I think I know what's about to happen. So we're sitting there and kind of quietly eating. And he's like, hey, so, I got some news for you. And just wanted to let you know that, Shelly and I decided to get married. And I can just, feel my body just
crunching the sandwich.
Super tense and just not sure. You just didn't know how to handle it, but it was upsetting.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't have been, it should have been like, oh, great.
Yeah.
Great. Good for you.
Did you like Shelly?
She was awesome.
Yeah.
She was so cool. But I was just like, didn't know how to handle it. And so I did not say a word. I just sat there just eating my sandwich, probably not even eating it, just and we just sat there in silence. And then he eventually started the car and drove me back to my mom's. It was really fucking weird. And I don't think we've ever even talked about it. Not because we're avoiding it. I always just forget. But I always just, I feel like I have to just, what was he? So just to know what he was thinking in that moment, how he felt.
Yeah.
So weird.
Amy Schumer.
Okay, so mom leaves dad.
Yeah.
Has an affair with my best friend's dad.
Oh, man.
Breaks up their family.
And I'm in
school. We're trying to still be best friends. Like, we were best friends. It was crazy. It's weird
because it always happens in the community. People forget that, like, you know, when you stick your dick into something that's, you know, nearby, the ripple effect is going to be fairly profound.
There are, that vagina is going to be at a PTA meeting with your wife next week.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
the whole town was affected by it.
Yeah. And so she was like, you know, she was Hester Prynne.
She was.
And maybe that's like sort of where it came from. Like, I was like, well, I love my mom. She's my family. So fuck you guys.
Yeah.
And then years later, I was like, mom, how could you do that? You know, but not till a while later.
Did you say that to her?
When I was 16, I got angry. I was running away. That's when I started really stealing a lot.
Yeah.
It was funny. I played volleyball like pretty seriously.
Right.
I was on this club team and it was preliminaries for the Junior Olympics. And my mom was a chaperone. We had to go to San Jose from New York to San Jose. And I got caught stealing at this tournament. So I was benched the whole tournament. And she just like, so I'm standing there with my knee pads around my ankles. And my mom's just like standing there for the whole weekend having to stare at me with hatred. But I could always stare right back at her and be like, yeah, but you ruined my life.
My dad had a drug problem for a while, and then
which drug?
I'm assuming a few, but mostly cocaine.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Oh, so that's why your parents split up, because of the drugs. So your mom was like, "Fuck this! I'm going to Chicago with the kids. If you get your shit together, give me a call."
Yeah.
Okay.
And so he didn't call for several years.
Yeah, he wanted to really finish up whatever he was working on.
It's a business to an end.
Yeah.
But he started getting in touch a little bit later, and he was going to Portland to work in construction, and Chicago wasn't working out too well for me. He's got his own things going on. We don't really talk that much.
You don't?
No.
Why?
It just was never a positive influence for me, like anything that I wanted to do. Like, he wasn't there to parent me, but he still wants to, you know, then offer advice. Yeah. But I'm like, he was like, wants me to be a super Christian. Like, he wants me, you know.
Oh, really? He's one of them?
Yeah, he's one of those.
When did that come around? After the drugs left?
Yeah, of course. You got to always replace one thing with another. Yeah.
Replace Coke with Jesus. Of course. I think that's the slogan.
And then out of the high school, just hanging out and working at canneries or Chuck E. Cheese.
Canneries? What's canneries?
You know, where you can groceries or can beans and broccoli and stuff at a factory.
You put it in cans?
Mm-hmm.
They have those in Portland?
Yeah. Well, they had them in Oregon. Yeah, in Salem.
Is that? I didn't know it was known for that. They're known for being cannery places?
Yeah, they had like a Flavor Right, the, you know, any type of frozen peas place.
Oh, yeah? Those,
yeah.
That's where they come from?
Mm-hmm.
And did you, would you operate machinery?
No, never. I would just have to pick out stalks of broccoli and put them in a chute and avoid putting my fingers close to blades. And then one day my job was to pick out like rats and snakes out
Come
of
on,
the stuff.
Man.
And yeah, that was the last day I went.
Come on, man. Out of the vegetables?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah.
Dead ones?
Yeah.
Well, because they'd steam
Because they just kind of get rooted up. They're not, like, plucked out by individual farmers, you know? They're just put all together. And so when they're originally dumped, they're just dirt and rocks and vegetables and dead rodents.
Really?
I let a lot of rats go through.
You did not?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm not. You think, do I look like a person that touched a lot of rats?
No.
No.
Wyatt Cenac.
I was born in New York. New York City. I was born in New York, and I lived there for a little while. My mother and father lived there, and then they split up when I was about a year old.
Oh, really young?
Yeah, my mother remarried, and then maybe when I was about three, my mother, stepfather, and I moved to Texas, and we moved to Dallas, Texas.
What was what happened with the original old man?
Where is he now?
Yeah.
He was murdered when I was four.
But you had a relationship with him?
Yeah. I mean, he was, I would still go visit. My grandmother, my maternal grandmother lived in New York. Yeah. So I would spend time with her, and then I would spend time with him as well, and his brother, who lived in New York as well. Like, I would see them all. And my grandmother, even after he got killed, like, my grandmother did a good job of trying to
keep you in the fold.
At least keep talking about him, because once he died, my uncle left and moved back to Grenada, which is where my father was from.
Really?
Yeah.
He just got murdered?
Yeah, he was a New York City cab driver, and he took a fare up to Harlem, and then they robbed him and shot him.
God damn it.
Yeah. No, it's pretty intense. I just recently, like about maybe 2 years ago, a friend of mine connected me to an NYPD detective who pulled up the file, and I got to see everything.
They had pictures of the scene?
They didn't have pictures of the scene, but there was, I always knew where it happened, but then this sort of laid it out in this way of, oh, well, the car, you know, once he was shot, he died on this, you know, instantly, and then his foot was on the gas, and the car went across the median and crashed into some cars, and then there were some witness accounts and stuff like that. It was really amazing. And then at the end of it all, there's the guy. Like, they caught the guy, and I had his whole rap sheet, and it was weird to just see that and to just get a fuller picture of that guy. And he lives in Brooklyn, and there's like a whole kind of weirdness of just, oh wow, this person, like, I've seen his whole life. I see his rap sheet.
He didn't stay in jail after murder?
No, he did. He got a really short sentence for it. I think he was 16 when he did it. And so even that, it's kind of amazing, because I just think about, like, he was 16 and this thing, like, it just set him on a path. Weirdly enough, was doing time in North Carolina at the same time I was in college in North Carolina.
Where'd you go?
I went to University of North Carolina. But it's just strange, these little sort of intersections of life where it's like, oh yeah, we were both in North Carolina at the same time.
It's in a different institution.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, different state-run institution. Both not the best football teams. Really underperforming football teams in both situations.
But wait, so now the dude who murdered your biological father lives in the same city as you.
Yeah.
As a free man.
Yeah.
Do you have any compulsion to meet his murderer?
Not really.
Yeah.
No. And people have asked me that once I sort of discovered it and everything. And I was just like, I don't really have anything to say to the dude. Like, it's, if anything, there is a part of me where I look at him and what he did, and there's a sense of, you know, he is partially responsible for me being who I am.
In a good way.
Kind of, yeah. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it's, I've actually joked about it on stage, because it is this thing where it's like, I'm not going to send him a Father's Day card, but there is this element of like, oh no, this was a traumatic event that changed me in the way I saw the world.
Mm-hmm.
And you're the person that did that. Like, you, who knows how differently my life would be. I'm assuming I'd probably still be in the same place.
Right.
But maybe my father would have been the deadbeat that he was to my sister, to me. And maybe I would have dealt with that. Or maybe I'd have gone to New York and lived with him, and it would have changed my impression of him in that way or something.
The whole trajectory.
Yeah.
Who knows? You know, like, if you grew to favor him over your mother, who the hell knows where that would have went?
Yeah. But it's
wild.
But so in that way, it is like, oh yeah, this one thing, like that idea of the butterfly effect or something like that. Like, oh, this is that one instance of, oh yeah, here it is.
Amy Mann.
You know, my childhood was pretty fragmented. My mother left when I was 3 years old. There was a lot of drama around that because
she ran off with a guy, and he was married, and they took me, and my father didn't know where I was, and it was just like a lot of
really,
yeah, there was a lot of drama.
How did that play out?
I was eventually found and brought back, but you know, it was probably like 9 months later. And
so you were a 3-year-old.
Yeah.
Your mom kidnapped you with this dude that she ran off with, who was also married, and took you to another state or
Out of the country.
Really?
Yeah.
Am I supposed to know this?
No, I mean, you mean like, should you not know it?
Well, no. I mean, like, I don't know if we ever talked about it before. But
I don't think so. I don't know.
That's like this is from Virginia.
Yeah.
And where'd they take you?
I think we wound up in England, but I think we spent some time in Germany. I remember being in Amsterdam.
What was the plan?
I don't know what the plan was. I think he was going to get a job.
The guy was.
And just move. Yeah, they were moving there.
Just overnightish.
Yeah.
Did they both get divorced before they did this?
I don't think so.
Wow.
And he took his kids because he had kids. Yeah.
So it's like, here's your new family.
Yeah.
Was this a guy from the neighborhood? Somebody that your father knew?
Somebody who worked for my father.
Oh my God.
I know. There's a lot of drama. There's a lot of drama in it, Mark.
So did someone have to go international to get you?
My father had hired a private detective, but I think he found out where I was by accident because, he was in advertising. He was in the same business.
Yeah.
And I think how I was found was that my father just, in the course of doing business had run into a guy who said, oh, I saw that guy that used to work for you. And it was him.
Okay. So does your father fly overseas and get you?
I don't know. I think she flew back with me, and then I was taken to my grandparents for a month, which is crazy. Like, I mean, it's all fucking crazy.
Have you ever kind of like sat them down or him down and gotten the deets on this thing?
Yeah, he told me most of this. She obviously doesn't. I know her now, but I didn't. I sort of didn't really see her until, I got back in touch with her in my mid-20s. But she obviously doesn't really want to talk about it.
So she was out of the picture that whole time.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
And
it's bananas. Oh, here's another detail.
Yeah.
I think we were all staying at a hotel or something, and I was 3 years old playing by myself in the parking lot, and he hit me with a car and knocked me unconscious.
The other guy.
Yeah, the guy, the boyfriend.
On purpose.
I probably not.
Oh my God.
Probably not. But he did yell at me for causing an accident.
For being in the street in front of his car.
That's right.
So that is some that I've never heard of child abuse where the child was hit by an automobile. you were not just hit, you were hit by an automobile and then blamed for that.
Yeah. Well, look. It was only a VW Bug.
Oh, so, you could have won.
I could have.
Tom Arnold.
When I was 10, he married the next door neighbor, and she had a couple kids, and that was terrible. It was terrible because she'd come from a very corporal punishment background, and I was the oldest, and she was going to tame me.
Yeah.
And it made my life, it was a... Not a pleasant experience. I get along with her now, of course. I know it was hard for her because I was like, oh my God, you're taking my dad. But he did ask me if he could marry her. And I remember saying, well, yeah, because of course.
But she beat everybody up?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, she had a chart on the fridge and check marks during the day for when my dad got home. And this is how many whips you'd get. And and the saddest thing, and I just thought this recently because my son's born, was the times I was in bed, man, I was loaded up with the extra underwear, the padding, because I knew it was coming because there had been a lot of check marks next to my name. And he would say, oh, come on, Ruth, I don't want to. She goes, God damn it, it's him or me. And so you're 10,
my God.
And you're hearing that, and you're like, oh, my God, I don't want my dad to get divorced. And then you march down there and say, let's do it.
Yeah, I want my dad to be happy.
Yeah.
I'll take the hit.
Yeah.
Bruce Springsteen.
How could you live in a house where there was so much kindness and great cruelty?
Yeah.
It was very, very difficult to understand those things, and it set you very on edge. You had your own little local minefield that you had to walk every single day, which caused a great deal of anxiety and neuroticism in me.
Right.
You were always on edge. You were always waiting for, you know, you had this one great thing, but then you were always waiting for the other shoe to drop. Made me a very nervous kid.
My mom got divorced 3 times when I was a kid growing up.
Yeah.
You know, that was a little rough. We lived a lot in small apartments and moved around Long Island.
Right. Just weird stepdads?
Yeah, weird stepdads. I remember I had one stepdad who refused to let me call him by his name. His name was Cordell. I could not call him Cordell. I had to call him. He made me call him Daddy, which is, in retrospect, weird. But the craziest thing, I'll be embarrassed that my dad is probably going to listen to this, but my dad got into a fist fight with my stepdad in front of me.
Which
when I was a
stepdad?
Kid. Stepdad two.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was crazy. As a kid, to see, like, your real dad and your stepdad, like, go for it. I was young. I was 9 or 10.
What was that about?
I remember seeing it. Like, my dad and I had come back from apple picking, seeing my stepdad, who was in a bathrobe. My stepdad was a truck driver for a supermarket, you know, and my dad came in, and he goes, "You don't say fucking hello to me, Bill." And my dad's like, "I said hello to you. It's your fucking fault if you didn't hear it." Then all of a sudden, my stepdad picked up a coffee mug, fucking wailed it at my dad's head. My dad ducked, and it exploded on the wall.
Then
all of a sudden, like, they just went at it like a grappling thing around my kitchen table. My dad's the most nice, you know, well-adjusted guy. And then all of a sudden, apples are flying. So, like, I'm throwing apples. My dad is throwing apples. And they fight out until they, like, literally leave the house, like, outside the front door.
Oh, no.
Like, that kind of fighting. My dad's a pharmacist. And again, like, you know, and my pharmacist fighting a truck driver. It was like something like out of a Clint Eastwood movie. It was like, boom, boom. It was insane stuff. You know, that was like, yeah. So
how did that resolve itself?
It resolved itself very cheesily, which was hours later, I got on the phone and Cordell was on the phone in my house and my dad was on a payphone. And they apologized to each other while I was in the middle. Like, you know, because I could
for
be
your
like,
benefit?
Yes, for my benefit to hear them apologize.
Like
to each other.
They all decided probably on your mom's instruction
yes.
This wasn't a good thing for the kid to see.
Exactly. So they had to like get together and apologize over me. So that was a pretty terrible.
Do you remember being upset? What was your reaction? Were you crying? Was it like,
oh yeah. I mean it's
it was all just chaos.
It was chaos and also like crazy because it's like you're watching your dad get into a fight. And
did
like,
you
I
like the guy?
I didn't Bill? Like this. My Bill, my dad loved. My stepdad hated him. He was like an abusive fuck of a dude, like a terrible.
Oh,
dude.
Your dad is Bill.
My dad is Bill. Yeah,
and your stepdad was
Cordell.
Just, oh, that was Cordell.
That was Cordell, and he was just an abusive, bad dude. But yeah, you know, he'd come home like literally an arm in a cast because he got into a fight with you know at like work. You know, like
did he beat you up?
Yeah, like a little bit. I mean, like I say it very cavalierly, but yeah, like I mean, we would get into some fucking fights. Like
I can't even imagine that.
Like I lived on a farm, and like we had horses and dogs and stuff, and like I would talk back a lot. Like that was my thing. And
that's what comics do.
Yeah, and so that's like
that's how we find our voice.
Yeah, I got into a lot of. I was talking to like people this weekend. I was like, I got into a ton of fights all until like eighth grade, and I was like, oh. I got to stop
this.
Did
you win?
Yeah, because I was fighting a 40-year-old guy at home. Like, that's why I was getting good at it.
It's so funny. Out of all the people in the world, I would never assume you were a scrapper.
Oh, God. Big time. Like,
holy shit.
Because you fight this big fucking 40-year-old dude, this fat dude who's strong and, like, literally, like, throwing a pitchfork at me. Like, and dodging a pitchfork.
Get the fuck out of here.
Like, but because of that kind of style of fighting, I think I never realized how strong I was. So, like, when I was in
the dodging pitchfork style.
Yeah, well, like, it was like, you know, you just learn to be like more of a grappler, you know? Like, you know, a lot of like just slaps and runs or punches in the stomachs and runs. And, but when I was in sixth grade, I got into this fight with this kid and he like gave me like a sixth grade punch, like, boom, you know, a punch in the face. I remember this is ninth grade, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I grabbed him by the neck and we were by a car and there was like a car fender there. And I was like, whap, whap, like his face into a car fender. We were both suspended from school.
Yeah.
You know, and because he started it, I got to go back and he got kicked out. But it was, but like that kind of like, did not realize like I was fighting for a much, you know, yeah, I was, yeah.
You're going for the fucking money. You're gonna, did you have, did they have to pull you off him?
I remember that was the time where like my knuckles were bloody from just like punching.
Oh my God.
That was a rough, yeah. I was a bruiser as a kid.
I had no fucking idea. Paul Scheer, badass.
But I stopped. Fuck? I stopped that. You had to give it up? I had to give it. Went to comedy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just turned into a different direction. Yeah. I couldn't. I remember, like, honestly just being, like, I think at one fight when I was a kid, and this is, like, an early, like, yeah, like 10th or 11th grade, being like, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't like this.
Like, I had fresh earrings when I was 14 or 15, and that pissed him off to no end. I hadn't consulted anybody about it. I think I got mom to sign off on it.
Right.
He just hated that because he was a left-wing political activist who beat his wife and child and was kind of homophobic, right? And and I was getting girly at 14 and 15. I was growing my hair long. I was trying to eyeshadow and rouge and stuff like that.
What was the influence there? Who were the musicians?
David Bowie and Lou Reed.
Yeah.
I mean, I was into it. I was very into it. So I remember the day that he knocked me hard enough to actually knock out an earring and the post dug into my neck. And that was the day that I wound up getting thrown out of the house. I had to go live with my dad.
How old were you?
14 or 15.
So that was just a fucking mess.
It was a mess, and the thing is about that period of time was that I had at that point a strong network of friends. Like for the first time, I was close enough to grown up that my friends weren't just my friends.
Yeah.
There were meaningful people in my life who I talked to about my life and who I was constructing that amazing teenage life that you get with. Right? They know your struggle, you know. And suddenly, you know, there was this big blow up day about which I remember only that he did that, right? He was slapping me around the face hard enough to make the earring dig into my neck and make me bleed. And I went back to my room and just sat there listening to music. And my mom came down the hall to see it was time for dinner. And I'd been sitting there for half an hour contemplating what I was going to do to express that I didn't deserve this and the extent of the rage. So I punched my window. I put my fist through the window.
Right.
It felt like $1 million.
I bet.
Never felt so good in my whole life. It was like, holy shit. And the house melted down, right? It was like, there was this immediate, you know, my stepfather screamed that he was going to beat everybody's ass even worse. And my sister's crying. It was a whole terrible scene.
You're bleeding?
Yeah, bleeding all up the arm. And I just felt like $1 million. It was like, you know what? I mean, it just felt so good to show them what it felt like inside.
Yeah.
To, you know, there was no way of getting it through their heads.
And also it's sort of a way of trumping the pain
exactly
that they inflicted or that he inflicted.
Yeah. No, that's right. It's like you
win in some weird
exactly
way.
Exactly. No, that's right. That was my victory.
But bar none, I think this is the end of the beginning of the end for us was there was a loaded handgun in our house. And I remember Cordell having my mom like held like a hostage with a handgun and seeing that as a kid.
What, during a fight?
During a fight. And that was like, I remember like going, what is going on? Like that, you know,
that's
as a
horrifying
kid. And as a kid, I can say it now and I go, wow. Like even thinking about it now, I'm like, wow, that was crazy dark. Like that's insane. But like as a kid, it doesn't register. I don't think it's like, what's going on?
Well, do you
on?
Just probably sense that your mom's in danger?
Yes. And that was like, and
that's
I remember
horrifying.
Like,
you must have just been crying all the fucking time.
Yeah. And I remember saying to my mom, like, we got to get out of here. Like, I mean, my mom's like, no, it's okay. It's okay. I was like, we got to go.
Oh,
we got to go.
Did he hit her too?
Yeah, he hit me, hit her. I mean, but you know what? Never to the point of like, we never were hurt. So I think that was like that was always my kind of, like line, like, oh, well, we don't have broken arms or we don't have this or we don't have that.
Was there some party that felt bad for him?
No, he wasn't. No, I thought of it like he didn't
cry and apologize and fucking, you
he
know.
Would apologize, but he was like an older brother instead of a dad.
Yeah.
Like, so it was like that kind of relationship. So it was a lot of like, yeah, a lot of like, and a lot of like, you know, like I think he was like competitive for my mom's affection towards me, which is insane. It's like, well, that's a mother and a son. That's not, you're a husband. And, you know, so it would come out a lot in Indian burns, like that kind of stuff, which would really hurt. But I do remember calling we called Child Protective Services at one point and they came to the house and they interviewed our parents side by side. And they were like, does this happen? And my mom's like, no.
Cordell and your mom.
My mom. And they're like, no. And they talked to me and I was like, yes. And they're like, oh, well, the kid's lying. The parents are telling the truth.
And then she'd get a beating for that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course. Like, my mom, I think, rebelled in the most crazy way. Because my dad's so nice and great. And the man she's married to right now, also wonderful and great.
So you're saying that okay, so Cordell was like, your mom's fuck you to your dad.
Yeah. I think that she didn't. She was like, I want something different. And she got something insanely different. You know, like, and then my mom kind of wised up at a certain point. And she's like, oh, we're out of here.
Yeah.
And
guy's throwing a pitchfork at my kid.
This guy has more guns than he has shirts, you know.
Holy shit. Hell. How'd she shake him? That sounds like it would have been hard to shake that guy.
This is, you want to hear how you shook him? This is a crazy thing. My mom created, she pretended that he won a trip, a hunting trip. She like created these envelopes and was like, Cordell, you won this trip. And
she did the layout and everything?
She did everything, and she got him plane tickets, got him a hotel, and created this whole like fantasy 7 days away from him. The minute he left the house, a moving truck pulled in, and we got all of our shit out of the house, and we took off.
You left Cordell's farm?
We left Cordell's farm, and we moved into a small one-bedroom apartment or two-bedroom apartment, and just that was it.
My stepfather died. He died, and my sister called in the middle of the night to say Mike's dead. And then I went on tour a month or two later, and stuff started to crack open. It was really amazing. I just started to feel free with my feelings, you know? And
in general?
Well, no, with just my vision, my ability to think about that time and how far I'd come. I lived in Iowa at the time.
You think that some impact was that, you know, the abuser was dead?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's like I tell survivors when they come up to me in the merch line, it's like, you know, they'll say, well, I survived abuse. Has your abuser died yet? And they will say, you know, no. And I say, I want you to be ready, because it is, I mean, I hate to say this because you don't wish death on anybody. It's wonderful when your abuser dies. It's wonderful. It's like nothing in the world. It's like you are free. Yeah, I mean, there's a feeling that you will never be free of what you were. You know, there's that. But there is this, you know, even though my stepfather was helpless at the end of his life, but to know that the person who used to hurt you no longer can is very, very, very deep. It's unbelievable.
You forgive him?
No. Which I hate about myself, but I don't.
My biggest fear, and it was a fear that I had as a kid, because there would be times where, as a kid, my mother might show up somewhere, or she would have somebody like spy on me and do shit like that. Like, it was a really paranoid house growing up, where I remember one time I was supposed to leave my car at a certain place, and I was picking up this girl that I was seeing at the time. We were going to go to Six Flags Amusement Park. So I was supposed to leave my car on one side of town, Six Flags on another side of town, both far from where my folks live. And so I go pick up the girl. She's like, we should drive to Six Flags together. It'd be romantic, because we were supposed to ride with her sister. And I was like, well, I don't know. My mom says I, you know. Yeah. And then she kind of like touched my leg and it was like, okay, let's do it. We drive, and I had to take the highway, and I think that was like, my folks didn't want me on the highway. Get there, fine, come back, and my mother used to make me carry around this cell phone, one of those big ass car phones. Phone's ringing nonstop. The girl answers it, and I'm just like, I immediately hang it up, and I'm like, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah.
And then I eventually answer it. My mother's like, you know, why didn't you pick up the phone? I was like, I don't know if you called the right number. This is the first time it rang. And I dropped the girl off, and I get home, and as I'm pulling into the driveway, I see my stepfather has been tailing me at some point, and his car is coming behind mine. And so he somewhere picked me up on the road, followed me back to our house. What I learned is that my mother sent somebody to go see if my car was where it was supposed to be. And this is what she tells me later. She goes see if my car is where it's supposed to be. When it's not, she calls the police, knowing I took it. She calls the police, thinking that the police will pick me up and I'll learn a lesson.
How old were you?
I was probably 17. And so there was, and then when I get home, like, she has sort of opened up all of, like, all my papers, anything that I had, like, locked up, and, like, I used to keep, like, a briefcase where I could kind of lock things up. All that stuff is spread out on her bed and on the kitchen table, and it was one of those things where it's almost like the police have come in and raided the place, and they're just going through everything.
But it's like violating.
Violating in a way that was like, this doesn't even have anything to do with the crime at hand. Like, the crime was that I took a car on the highway. You're now looking at this as like, well, let's go through
his diary.
Yeah, let's basically go through all this shit. And so there was always that sense of violation. And that's what I lived with, was this constant sense of you never know who's your real friend. Like, there was a girl I knew. She's a girl I grew up with. She at one point told me that my mother had asked her to befriend me just to
keep an eye on you.
Yeah, and just to report information
back. A mole.
But yeah. And she did that to one of my roommates when I lived out here, and she was like, tell me, like, just keep me in the loop on stuff. And it was just like this very strange, paranoid, distrustful house. Halfway through my first semester, I remember I was failing out.
Yeah.
And then they would send a midterm report to your house. And so I'm in the shower, and my roommate comes knocking on the door of the bathroom, and he's like, "Hey, your folks are on the phone." And I was like, "Well, I'm in the shower. I'll call them back." And so then he goes back, and a minute later, he's like, "They're not getting off the phone. They're saying get out of the shower." And so I'm just like, "Oh shit!" Like, you know, I'm thinking, "Did somebody die? Like, what the fuck is going on?"
Yeah,
I go in, and I don't even have to put the phone next to my ear. My mother and stepfather screaming so loud about my grades at that point, and just like, "You're failing out of everything. We will come down there." And my roommate and his girlfriend can hear the whole thing. And it's just this very strange. It was like, it was this thing of, oh shit, I have to get my act together because I don't want to go back there. Like, that was it.
Like, you know, I'm not going back.
Yeah. And that was, I mean, that house, like, it was, you know, there was a lot of distrust. There was a lot of yelling. There was a lot of that stuff. So it was like, oh, right, I don't want to go back, but I'm also not this student that she wants me to be. I have to figure out who I am, and I've got to figure out, like, the classes I need to take to make this work so I never have to go back there.
Leslie Jones.
So you left here. You got a scholarship to Fort Collins. Now, Colorado is probably the whitest state in the world.
Absolutely, and probably still is the white. You know what? I think that's what they need to change.
I'm not
they
white enough to. For Colorado.
No, they would kick you the fuck out. They'd be like, "Yeah, you got some engine or something in you, son.
Yeah, got some Jew in there. There was some Jew in there.
What's going on? You ain't pure. You ain't pure." No, it not only are the is the very whitest town. Mm-hmm. It's the very purest. They have only the purest air there too. Mm-hmm. I think they check your lungs when you pass the border. That motherfucker. See, that's how. When I went up there and was working out, that shit was killing me.
The air, because it's too high altitude?
It was killing me, son.
Well, I mean, you get sick, you get tired, you can't breathe.
Oh, my God. It was killing me. And I still was the best basketball player on the team. Because,
were you the only black player?
Yes, I was the only black player, Mr. Marin, the only black player. Well, there was a light-skinned girl, but she really didn't count. Yeah. So, and she didn't come to the next year. So,
But how did that make you feel? How were you treated?
Literally, I got there and I didn't know that I was going to be the only black girl on the team. Literally, I was like, I don't know how this is going to work out because I'm very militant too.
Yeah.
So I'm very outspoken. So And so it's like when I walked into basketball practice, I walked in with a radio.
Yeah.
So I'm the stereotype.
Yeah, on your shoulder.
I walked in like I was going to the park to play ball because that's where I played at the park.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, it was an adjustment for me and I was very lonely. I was in Colorado and a lot of times I was like, oh, I was rebelling on all levels. So my coach knew that I was like at the point where I wanted to go home because he came to my apartment. I had my mattress in the living room because I just was like, this was so new to me. Like, I had my own place. I was like, this. If I could go back, I could go back with my mind now, oh God, I would have ran that place. I would have ran Colorado. Do you understand me?
Why'd you have your mattress in the living
room? Because I was scared. I didn't want to sleep in the room. It was nobody in the apartment with me. You know, I was fucking alone. I was scared. So I'm a kid. I was like 18. Mm-hmm. So when he came to the apartment, he was like, oh my God, you got to meet people. You got to meet other black people. So he found the BSU on campus, the Black Student Union.
Yeah.
Yes, there's a building full of black people on the campus. And I'm sending you
this
there.
This is where we keep them.
And this, and this, if you was to talk to him today, he would say that was the worst thing I ever did because I completely became a party animal.
My folks left me in 1969, which was a little unusual. Usually you're leaving them, but they left me in New Jersey in 1969 and went to California.
Right.
So that sort of left you on your own to continue parenting yourself as best as you could. And, you know, your life was yours from that point on.
Right.
You know? That suited me.
Yeah.
You know, it was just one of the things that for where I was at, I was independent already. I had the band. I had my own little community that I was a part of. I was making a few bucks on the weekend so I could survive. And I was happily independent.
Right.
So
not making a lot of money.
No,
right.
Of course you're making $20.
Right.
But anybody that couldn't live on $20 or $40 in 1969, having no dependents and no, you know, anybody could do that. You know?
So it was a different time.
Yeah, I mean, you ate for, you know, $3 a day,
right.
$4 a day was all you needed to eat. So it was just enough money to get by and have a good time on.
Terry Gross.
Well, my parents, when I decided to hitchhike cross country, they were very, very upset about it.
I'm upset now.
Well, now that I'm the age that I am, I think, like, my gosh, no wonder they were so upset. But my attitude then was, you know, you're not telling me what to do.
Right, fuck you,
like,
right?
I'm an adult.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's like, you don't control me anymore.
Yeah.
Dan Harmon.
For those of us who are not prodigies, mm-hmm. who are not blowing minds by 15, you know, I think it's better to grow up in a smaller town where you can just, you have this sandbox where if you decide at 22 that you want to do stand-up, you want to be a writer, you want to do, in Milwaukee, if you stood on a street corner and said, I'm a welder, and you did that 3 days in a row, sooner or later someone's going to give you a job welding. Like, it's just, it was, and that same went for writers. I mean, you didn't get paid anything.
Right.
But in the 5 years from when I declared myself a writer to when I was leaving for LA, I was like working for the mayor. I was doing like radio shows. It was like within Milwaukee, I was given every opportunity that I thought that I wanted, you know what I mean?
You, like, made it to the top.
If I wanted to write a play, I could write a play.
If I wanted to
do a radio commercial for Bacardi, there was always, you know, some ad campaign would come through and they wanted a cheap writer.
Yeah.
It was a nice place to cut your teeth.
President Barack Obama.
I started keeping a journal when I was around 20.
Yeah.
And, you know, kept it up until I went to law school.
Yeah.
So for about 7 years. Sometimes I go back and I read this stuff and I'm still the same guy, which is good.
Emotionally, or not? Obviously not emotionally, but I mean, there's moments where you can sort of lock in. Like, what parts of your journal are you like, oh, like, are there still struggles that you were having then that you have now?
Well, that's where stuff's changed in the sense that stuff that was bugging you by the time you're 53, either you worked it out or you just forgiven yourself and you've said, look, this is who I am.
Oh, but I got to write that down.
Right.
So I can just forgive myself?
Well, you know, assuming that
it wasn't too heinous.
You're not hurting anybody. No, but you know what I mean? I think that you, at that age, you're still trying to figure out.
Right.
Who are you? How do I live? What's my code?
Right.
What's important to me? What's not important to me? And you're sorting through all kinds of contradictions. And, you know, by the time you get to, into your 50s, hopefully a lot of those have been resolved. You've come to terms and come to peace with some stuff. And then some stuff you've just said, well, you know what, that's just who I am. I've got some flaws, I've got some strengths, and that's okay.
I think I had a good escape back then, though, in a way. Like, I feel like, I don't know, like, I love TV and movies, and I really got into,
Moses,
like, comedy.
And the Batmobile.
Yeah, Moses and the Batmobile. But, like, I really got into movies and TV.
And the
I
comedy
think
was a real reprieve.
Comedy, yeah. I listened to, like, Smothers Brothers albums. Like, I had all my dad's old Smothers Brothers albums, and just, like, it was just fun to kind of, like, sit and hear that. And I remember, like, even reading, like, an article. I think it was a Smothers Brothers article, like, where I think they had some messed up parents. And
right.
I was, like, and I remember going, like, oh, okay, well, that's cool, because maybe they had messed up parents, I have messed up parents. It evens out.
I hope that was a good experience for you. That was chapter one of Waiting for the Punch, Words to Live By from the WTF podcast. If you're interested in the book, please go ahead and pre-order it now. Go to markmaronbook.com, and you can still enter the sweepstakes to win a Casper mattress or Away luggage if you upload your pre-order receipt. If you're in New York City, come out to the Union Square Barnes & Noble on the day the book comes out, Tuesday, October 10th at 7 p.m. Brendan and I will talk and do a Q&A and sign books. You don't need a ticket. Just get there early enough to get a seat. We'll also be in San Francisco at the Alamo Drafthouse as part of Litquake. That's Friday, October 13th at 9 p.m. There are a few tickets left for that, so go to litquake.org to get your seats. Okay? All right. Should I play some guitar? Should I? I can. I don't have anything planned. I can play a little.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Moin, wir sind die Footballerei. Ich bin Kutsche.
Ich bin Flo.
Und ich bin Daniel.
Wir sind aber noch viele mehr. In der Footballerei gibt es American Football Freischnauze, überwiegend die NFL, in ganz vielen verschiedenen Formaten. Da ist für alle was dabei.
Das Frühstücksei zum Beispiel gibt es jeden Montag ab 5 Uhr als Podcast. In der Saison natürlich mit den ersten Reaktionen auf die Spiele des Wochenendes und in der Offseason versorgen wir dich hier mit allen frischen News aus dem NFL-Kosmos.
Dazu gibt es die bunte Welt der NFL in Kutsches Zirkus, hochspannende Kriminalfälle bei Hall of Crime und das Thema der Woche während der Saison in der Footballerei. Show.
Also, wenn dich American Football fasziniert, wirst du die große Auswahl in der Footballerei lieben. Wir freuen uns auf dich.